For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
For new folks, I'm Taigen Layton, the teacher here at Ancient Dragon Zengate, and I'm very happy to have giving the talk this evening Ben Penglaze, who's our assistant director and a member of our board. And thank you very much, Ben.
Thank you, Taigen. It's always an honor to give a Dharma talk here. Also, it's always a little intimidating. I listen to a lot of Dharma talks while I walk my dog, and they stick with me for weeks and weeks, things that people say. And so it's always a little intimidating thinking that maybe something I say might stick with you. Hopefully it's something intelligent. I also wanted to thank everybody for coming out on such a horrible cold night. This time of year I actually keep a little poem by Wu Man above my desk, and so I'll read it to you. I think it's kind of appropriate. 100 flowers blossom in spring, the moon shines in autumn, there is a fresh breeze in summer, and there is snow in winter. If your mind isn't occupied with trivial matters, every time is a good time. And whenever I read that, I always think, clearly Wu Man never spent a winter in Chicago. So, all right, but that's not what I'm here to talk about today. I wanted to talk about the precepts. In fact, the title of my talk, sort of a little jokingly, is Practicing the Precepts in the Age of Social Media. And I have a handout that I wanted to pass around. I think I have just enough for everyone. I wasn't sure how many people are going to come. Some folks towards the end might have to share. So the handout is the precepts, the way that they are formulated in our tradition. I wanted to talk about practicing with the precepts in the age of social media. I want to talk a little bit about sort of why I felt like this was something worth talking about. Talk a little bit about the precepts in our tradition, sort of an overview of how I think about them anyway. And then I think any one of the precepts could easily be the subject for an entire Dharma talk. And what I wanted to do instead was talk about social media usage and see how various precepts can apply to that, right? So let me talk a little bit about this topic, why this topic. For me, the new year is always a time of sort of recommitment to my own practice, recommitment to my own attempts to better myself, recommitment to my own attempt to make the world a better place. In our tradition, we just chanted the avowal of ancient twisted karma. So it's a moment of taking stock, for me, of myself, and of thinking about where I want to go. And I think the precepts are, for me, sort of fundamentally about that. The holiday and the new year is also, for me, a time of just incredibly increased Facebook and social media usage. I have friends literally scattered all over the United States. I have friends in England, friends in France, friends in Wales, friends in Brazil, friends in Australia. And so the holidays and the new year is always a way to reconnect with them and to see what they're up to. I'm also a professor, and so the weeks around the holidays are times when I have huge amounts of unstructured time and when I try to do things like write, trying to finish an article that I've been working on forever. And so there's the dark side of Facebook. It also becomes a way for me to spend huge amounts of time doing nothing but staring at, I don't know, videos of cats. So I thought it would be an interesting opportunity to talk about how these two things connect. And it's, I think, points to a larger challenge for us as modern-day Buddhists. The teachings of Shakyamuni Buddha, that the precepts sort of arise out of course, were teachings that he gave at a time when a time that was radically different than our time. Right? David Lloyd, who I like very much, talks about them as sort of Iron Age precepts, points out that at the time when Shakyamuni Buddha was teaching, there was no electricity. Very few people were literate. Shakyamuni Buddha's teachings didn't get written down until far after he passed away. And so there's a much larger question at work here of how do we take these teachings, how do we apply them to a world that is in some ways radically different than the world that, that certainly early Buddhism grew out of. At the same time, how can these teachings help us understand the challenges of our world? I want to especially talk about the precepts too, and I'll try to talk a little bit quickly about this, because of course today is the day that we celebrate the birth of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. The Buddhist tradition, I think, has been very focused on individual enlightenment and individual transformation, although clearly for the benefit of all living beings. I think Buddhism gives us really powerful insights into how the three poisons, greed, hatred, and delusion, can arise from ways in which we don't understand ourselves and don't understand the nature of reality. We live in a world, though, where greed, hatred, and delusion are now institutionalized. A world, again, that the early Buddhists, in some ways, might not have been able to recognize at all, where there are institutions that have assumed human-like characteristics. Corporations now legally are people. Also a world of powerful social forces that, whether we like them or not, we live with and live within. And I think this poses some really profound challenges. For us as Buddhists, if we care about liberating ourselves and liberating all living beings, how do we connect the insights of Buddhism with the activist traditions of the West, with the social theories of the West? Martin Luther King, among his many insights, I think, one of them was the power of civil disobedience, that we can challenge repressive institutions by refusing to participate in them, by withdrawing our participation from them. I think the precepts are useful because they can help us see how greed, hatred, and delusion operate through us and can help us sort of think in much more deeper ways about our own participation in these institutions and ways in which we might try to change those forms of participation. Right? So, let me talk a little bit quickly about the precepts. I gave you a handout here of the precepts. Taigen often emphasizes, and I like this formulation, that although the precepts might seem like sort of rules of conduct, really they're a way to express in our daily lives some of the awareness that we gain through zazen. You'll see that they're structured in three groups. Maybe what we could do, I teach, I'm a professor, and it's I never teach when I'm the only person talking, so it's really odd for me to do this, even though I give talks all the time. Why don't we go around the room? My mom was a school teacher too. And we can each read one of the precepts, starting with the three refuges. So I'll start, we can go around in a circle. I take refuge in the Buddha.
I take refuge in the Dharma.
I take refuge in the Sangha.
I vow to embrace and sustain right conduct.
I vow to embrace and sustain all good.
I vow to embrace and sustain all beings.
A disciple of Buddha does not kill.
A disciple of Buddha does not take what is not given.
A disciple of Buddha does not misuse sexuality.
A disciple of Buddha does not lie. Disciple of Buddha does not intoxicate mind or body of self or others. I left my glasses.
A disciple of Buddha does not speak of faults of others.
A disciple of Buddha does not praise self at the expense of others.
A disciple of Buddha is not possessive of anything.
A disciple of Buddha does not harbor ill will.
A disciple of Buddha does not disparage the three treasures.
So let me talk a little bit about the structure, although I'm really going to focus on two, maybe three of the 10 grave precepts. In a sense, it's the first three that are the most essential. Simply being here and sitting in the posture of the Buddha is taking refuge in the Buddha. And taking refuge in the Buddha and the Buddha's teachings, in a sense, implies all of the other precepts. The precepts also, if you think about them, are all interconnected. You know, practicing or thinking about one of the precepts in some ways implies all of the other ones, right? So they're all interconnected. Let me also say a couple of things that I think are particularly important for those of us who come from a Judeo-Christian cultural background. Even if, like me, you come from, you grew up in a fairly secular, fairly non-religious home, I think as sort of Westerners, we live in a world that's deeply shaped by a Judeo-Christian perspective. I think the first important thing is that the precepts, the way that I think about them is that they're something that you practice with. They're not commandments that you obey or fail to obey. They're not commandments that if you don't, that if you follow, you'll somehow be saved, and if you don't follow, you'll somehow be damned, right? That tends to, in my experience, simply provoke a lot of guilt and bad feeling and isn't really particularly helpful. Rather, they're tools. And I don't mean that in sort of in a narrow sense of sort of just instrumental things that we pick up, right? But they're a framework. They're something to practice with. They're something to work with to better our own ability to free ourselves and our own ability to work with others. I think for me, working with the precepts entails the process of constantly seeing how they can apply to different situations. And constantly seeing the subtleties in the precepts. Constantly seeing how I fail to follow the precepts. And I think this points to a second important point to make, I think especially from us who live in a Western tradition. I think the precepts are problematic if we see them as promoting a dualistic kind of thinking. And I think it's sort of easy in some ways to take them this way. If we look, for instance, the disciple of Buddha does not take what is not given, it would be easy to see this as based on the dualism of right and wrong, good and bad, but all sorts of other dualisms of a subject and object, a person who has something and someone else who doesn't have something. In some ways, I think, when we look at the precepts, we can see them as challenging this kind of dualism because in some ways they're sort of impossible. A disciple of Buddha does not kill. I don't murder anybody. I don't intend to murder anybody. At the same time, I think even driving a car, I'm contributing to global climate change. Eating food, even if I'm eating vegetarian food, that food is no doubt produced through systems that have killed other creatures. So I think there's a danger here if we see the precepts as building up a structure of sort of good and bad and right and wrong of the people who successfully follow the precepts and the people who fail to follow the precepts. The good enlightened Buddhists who have committed themselves to the precepts and bad other people who haven't. Buddhism, unfortunately, is not immune from the kind of fundamentalism that this dualism promotes that has infected so many other religious traditions. I think also it's important to while practicing the precepts, avoid the kind of self-righteousness that they can give rise to. I often think that the bodhisattva vows that we'll recite at the end of the service today are sort of deliberately voiced this way to not allow us to feel like we're let off the hook, right? We vow, well, we chant, delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them, right? How can you possibly do that, right? At the same time, dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them, right? So the opportunities for enlightenment, the opportunities for practice are also boundless. So let me talk a little bit about Facebook and social media and the precepts, right? And those of you who aren't as attached to Facebook as I kind of pathologically am can think about it in terms of all the many ways in which technology mediates the ways in which we communicate with each other, whether that's text or email or the other ways in which increasingly we communicate to each other through these technological means. And I think there's a fundamental paradox here of social media and more generally of the modern technological world that we live in. And that's that at the same time, we're both more interconnected than ever before. I can know about what's happening with friends of mine in Brazil and friends of mine in Australia in ways that I never would have been able to even 20 years ago. We're both more interconnected than ever before and also more isolated than ever before. And I think social media functions both of those ways. So let me talk about a couple of the precepts and offer you maybe a couple of examples. I think the precepts that most obviously apply to social media usage are the ones that have to do with right speech, right? These are also the ones that I personally have been working on the most myself. So, for instance, a disciple of Buddha does not speak of faults of others. A disciple of Buddha does not praise self at the expense of others. Now, I'm a professor, and so I function in a world where speaking of the faults of others and praising self at the expense of others are major career advancement strategies. So this is a challenge for me to work with these in a context where I'm continually encouraged to do these things. I think social media and Facebook also, in some ways, exist for this. Praising self at the expense of others and not speaking of the faults of others. Let me give you a somewhat trivial example and then maybe a more serious example. So on Sunday, a friend of mine who lives in Atlanta, who grew up in South Carolina, I think, who went to college in Florida, who went to graduate school in New Orleans, posted on Facebook on Sunday. She said, "It's far too cold to go out today, but we had a great time hiking on Saturday," and posted pictures of herself and her daughter, and her daughter was wearing a t-shirt and shorts. And of course, immediately my reaction was not, you know, to write, "Oh, that's great. Oh, you know, your daughter looks so much older." I immediately thought of all the snarky things that I could write. Right? Like, "Oh, it must be very cold there in Atlanta. Here it's 8 and I walk the dog anyway." Or, "Clearly it's very cold. Your daughter, you know, probably had to wear a sweater today." And of course I stopped myself from doing that and wondered, in reacting this way, what am I doing? My friend knows that Chicago's cold. She knows that Atlanta is warmer. Am I doing this to prove a point about how tough I am because I live in Chicago and can deal with the cold? Am I doing this to show her that she's, you know, not as tough as I am? Am I doing this to communicate with my friend, or I'm doing this to bolster my own sense of myself? I think likewise, there's the constant temptation on Facebook and social media to critique things that other people post. And I think that there is for me anyway, a certain kind of pleasure that comes from this. And I think I've really learned to pay attention to think deeply about my intentions when I'm responding critically to something someone has posted, or when I'm posting something that other people might respond critically to. Why am I doing this? What's the intention behind this? What kind of effect could this possibly have? And I say this because I have Facebook friends who run the gamut in their opinions. Facebook friends who are very in favor of concealed carry. Facebook friends who are anti-vaccination. Facebook friends who think that we should eat nothing but bacon all day long. I think that's just one of my Facebook friends, actually. I have Facebook friends who are police officers. And sort of the less trivial example, obviously there have been multiple incidents that have come to attention in the media in the past year or so of police officers acting in discriminatory and racist and violent ways against African-American men. And it's really clear that there's a deep problem in the way police forces in our society are structured, and that they disproportionately apply violence to young African-Americans. And I'm often tempted to post things on Facebook calling for things that I think should happen, like the creation of a better, more powerful, independent review board of the police force, like investigation and prosecution for police officers who commit crimes in the course of carrying out their duties. At the same time, I have friends who are police officers, and I have friends who are police officers who I know and trust and believe are good people who honestly are motivated by the desire to serve and protect others. And I know that those friends are part of an institution that is set up in such a way that it rewards them for acting a certain way. An institution that turns the blind eye if they act arbitrarily violently in certain ways. And so when I'm tempted sometimes to post things about police violence, I think about my friends. And I wonder, not just how are they going to react, but I wonder, when I post something, why am I doing this? Am I posting something because I think that Rahm Emanuel is going to read my Facebook post and decide to resign? Am I posting something because my friends who are police officers are going to have an insight into how they carry out their activities that they don't already have? They understand that already. When I post something criticizing the police force, am I letting myself off the hook? My friends who are police officers in all cities of the United States, we have abrogated to them the responsibility for dealing with people who society has rejected in many ways. They're the ones who are increasingly responsible for dealing with the mentally ill, for dealing with people who are living in situations of desperate poverty. When I criticize the police, am I letting myself off the hook? I'm equally responsible as a person who, as Ta-Nehisi Coates says, has come to believe he is white, right? There's structures of privilege that I benefit from every day that the police uphold and enforce. Is criticizing the police letting me off the hook? Is it letting me feel self-righteous about myself? So I think often when I post these things, not just about how are people going to react, am I praising myself at the expense of others, right? But also, what kind of sense of self am I trying to get? Now, the point of this is not that we shouldn't criticize things. The point of this is not that we shouldn't speak truth to power, as Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King did. The point, I think, is that we have to think about our intentions of when we do this. Are our intentions to attack somebody else? Our intentions to help draw greater critical awareness to social problems? Are our intentions actually to make ourselves feel self-righteous? Let me talk about two more of the precepts. I think I have time, and then I'll try to wrap it up. Another one of the precepts that I think about when I use social media that's maybe a little bit less obvious is not taking what is not given. I'm a professor, and I often use all kinds of photographs and images and music and video in my talks. I'm also a huge music nerd. And one of the interesting things about social media is how images and music and cultural products circulate in ways that they never have before, but also circulate in ways in which they're unmoored from the person or people who created them. And I think quite a bit in the images that I pass around and the music snippets that I post. Am I taking something that is not given? Increasingly, when I use photos in my lectures in class, I will not use them unless I'm pretty confident of that I know who the photographer is, right? And I think this is an obligation that goes beyond sort of the legal obligation, right? When I use images in class, I'm not profiting from those images. I'm not violating copyright in that narrow sense, right? But when I use an image that is an image that I don't know who made it, am I taking something from them? Am I not acknowledging the effort that they put into creating that image? When I post a YouTube link to a song, is the person who created that song, the people who created that song, are they going to get any reward from that song? Likewise, I think often when I post images of my daughter, which is the other thing that everybody does, daughters and pets, right? I post images of my dog all the time. When I post images of my daughter, am I taking something from her that's not given? Am I taking some of her privacy that she hasn't necessarily consented to give me? Am I taking some of her future ability to control images of herself that she hasn't necessarily given me? The final precept, I think, that I think about when I use social media is the precept about intoxication. A disciple of Buddha does not intoxicate mind or body of self or others. I think the precepts lead us to think about intoxication beyond intoxication in terms of drugs and alcohol, although it also encourages us to think about that. We live in a society that in a lot of ways promotes intoxication, a society that promotes distraction, a society that promotes the promise, that hands out the promise that we can escape from the present. If only we consume something, if only we engage in something, if only we do something, that we'll somehow be fulfilled in some ways at the present moment, we're taught, is not fulfilling. And I think about this with my Facebook usage and my social media usage. Is it promoting interconnection? Is it helping me connect with people? Or is it an escape? There's a promise of fulfillment which the present moment seems not to provide. Is it a way for me to fill those moments where I don't have anything to do? And of course, one of the things that you learn very quickly, I think that I learned very quickly, and yet I have to keep learning over and over again after spending 3 hours looking at posts of cat videos, is that promise of fulfillment is a promise that's endlessly delayed. It's a promise that isn't realized, that when I emerge from spending too much time fondling my device, I realized that I didn't really gain anything from it. And I think this is the basic dynamic of intoxication. So I think this precept is encouraging us to understand how intoxication functions. How do we get drawn in to this idea that if only we consume something, if only we do something, we're somehow going to feel more fulfilled? And, of course, that promise is a promise that's endlessly delayed, that drives us to consume more and more and more. Right? So, let me finish here, I think, on how social media, I think, and more broadly, our modern technologically minded, technologically mediated world, is both a challenge and can also present I think a profound opportunity as well. I said that the fundamental paradox of social media is that we're both more interconnected with people than we've ever been before, and yet also more isolated. I think when we think about this, we can see how, if we think critically about social media usage, if we think about our intentions of how and why we use social media or the ways in which we communicate with other people, we can really see in a kind of common everyday way here, examples of two of the main insights of Buddhism. This is why I want to chant the Heart of Great Perfect Wisdom. I think social media usage for a lot of us reveals this constant drive, attempt to create a self. This constant attempt to create a brand, to create an image of ourselves, and the effort that we often put into maintaining and burnishing and polishing that image of ourselves. On the one hand, we can see this as a delusion. On the other hand, we can see this as a profound example of the Buddhist teaching of anatta, right? Or no self. That we can see that the constant effort that we're encouraged to put into creating ourselves points to how empty that sense of self is. How really there's no substantial persistence essence of ourselves. I think more largely, too, it points to the ways in which the world that we live in is a world that we actively create, a world that we actively try to produce, a world that we try to draw others into. But it's a world that's fundamentally a world of emptiness, a world that's devoid of any inherent lasting substance. I think we can try to run from no self and run from emptiness. Or I think we can embrace and avow them as we embrace and avow our ancient twisted karma. And I think that the precepts for me really are a fundamental way in which I can watch myself giving in over and over again to my ancient twisted karma. I can watch patterns of greed, hatred, and delusion as they pop up over and over again in my daily life. And the way in which I can try to be more mindful of how those patterns manifest themselves, and I can try to understand better, even when I give in to them, the ways in which they operate in my life. And I think it's only by being aware of them and thinking about them and watching them operate that we can also start taking the steps to changing some of those patterns as well. So, I'll leave it there.
Thank you very much, Ben. Very helpful talk. Comments, questions, responses, please. Okay.
I was just saying thank you.
Thanks.
It's in Gasho.
Yes. Comments or responses?
Oh, I do. Thank you for a nice talk. You know, I had not really thought of Facebook, you know, in terms of the precepts and everything. And my relationship to Facebook is really a pretty unsophisticated, passive. But it's an interesting experience because I didn't have a Facebook page until like last December, or December 2013. And I was trying to stay connected with relatives overseas in Scandinavia. And I would send emails, but they wouldn't return them. And I said, well, you know, we should communicate more. And they said, well, why don't you get on Facebook? And so I get on Facebook, and they're all there. They put their full names on there, which I would never do. I have a pseudonym kind of. But it really served to connect our family. And so half of my Facebook page is in postings in Norwegian with little translations and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So that worked pretty good. And then I knew that I had a little bit of a breakthrough because about 6 months ago, my daughter actually friended me. So it's kind of like, you know, up to that point, I was not, you know, I was persona not about it. So, but yeah, I have to reflect. I don't post much, and you know, I'm not really a public. I'm not always in the role of presenting myself so public. So I have kind of a different perspective on the whole thing. But it's interesting.
Yeah, well, I think that's the dynamic is that, well, as with all sort of technologically mediated communication, it holds out this promise that we can connect with other people, while at the same time, that connection is necessarily this distant connection, right? That connection is necessarily not a face-to-face connection. And so you're forced to communicate in ways that the medium is already structured for you, right?
Mm-hmm.
you're forced to present yourself through a framework that shapes, whether you want to or not, the way in which you present yourself. And I think also, since it's not it seems like it's a face-to-face, like it's a way of communicating with someone, but because it's not, I think it leads people to interact with each other in ways that I think we rarely would if we were actually face-to-face. And I think also there's something about that, you know, they friended me. There's something really visceral about when you post something and people like it. Right? There's something really visceral about that. You feel like, ooh, like, oh, I'm special. So I got 25 likes or whatever. You know? I think it really hits that sense of like, I'm a special person that other people like. Well, of course, being, you know, just this image that you've put out there of yourself. Yes, Michael.
I definitely have a pretty strong guilt complex myself, and I'm someone that's really often, even though I'm able in the end to take an objective view, I very much stuck in a dualistic experience of life, and I always have these, I'm always looking for answers, or I'm like, I do something and I feel bad about it the whole time, and I know it, or when I feel like what I'm doing is wrong, I want to know, like, how can I stop, or like, what do you do when you realize that what you're doing is wrong or a distraction, and you know, I'm always looking for these kind of like concrete things, and so I wanted to comment just to say that I really appreciate the reminder of paying attention to your actions rather than trying to fix them immediately. You know, just to practice that awareness and to have it be more of a process, you know, of learning rather than solving.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. I mean, that's very much my experience of working with the precepts, is sort of seeing over and over again how I get drawn into doing things that are harmful for myself or for others. And I think developing a greater awareness of that. And then I think I think the precepts draw a lot of attention to intention, right? To get us to think about what was the intention behind doing something. If I did something that harmed someone, was that my intention in doing that? You know, when I did something. Now, was it just a flippant offhand comment that I made? Oh, yeah, so-and-so is an asshole. What's the intention behind that, you know? And I think it's only by being able to be more aware of how these patterns manifest themselves in these subtle ways that we can start taking steps to changing them. But thanks. Yeah, it's an ongoing process, without a doubt.
So... I was struggling a little bit listening to your talk because it seemed like intentionality was another way of coming at the precepts, but for me that has been a difficult aspect in action because you can, in itself, can kind of like dive into good and bad duality when you talk about intentionality, kind of like Kantianism sort of approach to morality is difficult for me, to the point where it can become like an inactive life, where you're just kind of circling around the intention of an action.
Sure.
So I just kind of wonder if you could maybe clarify for me a little bit about, I had previously viewed the precepts as a way of like indicating whether or not we were following the Buddha, as opposed to good and bad ways of being, and I still see intentionality as a dualistic mindset. I don't know if I'm expressing myself clearly, but it still kind of drives at this like mental activity, which is like, is this good or bad way of thinking? So I don't know if I'm really asking a question more than just asking for maybe some clarification about your distinction between action and intention.
Yeah, sure, okay. I think what I was trying to point to is that we live in this world of incredibly complicated causes and effects where we can't always control the result of something that we do, right? And that what I try to pay attention to and think about is when I engaged in an action or said something or did something, did I intend for it to harm someone or not? Right? And rather than thinking about it as good or bad, in fact, in some ways, you know, once I say or do something, whatever I have said or done is subject to all of these complex causes and conditions that a lot of them that are beyond my control. But if I intended to, if I intended to help someone, I feel like then it, at least I'm operating in a way that's aimed at helping people, right? And I think likewise, I think when I act automatically doing something, I think it's helpful for me to step back and say, you know, when I was going to write a flippant comment on my friend's post about it being warm in Atlanta, and I'm like, why am I doing this? What's behind this? And not in the sense of good or bad, but in the sense of, am I doing this to be funny, or am I doing this because I think it's going to bolster my sense of, you know, I'm a tough guy who can live in Chicago and she's a weak southerner who doesn't know. You know what I mean? I think that was what I meant to say.
And just to follow up a little bit, I think it's not a matter of some judgment, good, bad, good intention, bad intention, but just to foster awareness of the whole process, as Michael was indicating, just to have a vehicle for reflecting on what's going on and seeing the complexity of that. So it's not about reaching some judgment so much as an ongoing process of paying attention. But thank you for the question. Brian, did you have something?
Thank you for that talk. I've heard it said before, of course, that the precepts are not, you know, 16 separate things, but one thing. And something you said earlier made me see the grave precepts in terms of all of them are, they seem to be different ways of what it says a disciple doesn't do are different ways of trying to create or build up or sustain or protect a sense of self. Hmm. You know, if we're killing or if we're taking what's given or misusing sexuality or lying or whatever, that we're doing that in order to make this thing we think is a self, and how really empty that is and how it doesn't work.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, along with making a self, it's also cutting ties with others, denying interconnection, and those two things happening at the same time, right?